Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Malaysia Flight 370, Russia's Crimea annexation and sanctions, military sexual assault, and more. A land grab, Joe Biden called it, Crimea annexed to Russia. Russia's Vladimir Putin, anything but apologetic.
In the hearts and minds of our people, Crimea has always been an integral part of Russia.
GM recalls, and Toyota will pay big, $1.2 billion for concealing safety defects, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder.
Today, we can say for certain that Toyota intentionally concealed information and misled the public about the safety issues behind these recalls.
And week two of Malaysia Flight 370, with anguish from relatives of the missing, gone. Hard to hear. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Michael Hirsch of National Journal, Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What are we witnessing with Russia, Crimea, and the West? Are you giving up on Flight 370? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Michael Hirsch, chief correspondent for National Journal, with an eye on all things foreign and domestic. Michael Hirsch, welcome back to On Point.
Well, thanks for having me, Tom.
Great to have you. And from Washington, with a sharp eye and ear on the Beltway and well beyond, Karen Tumulty is with us, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Karen, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom. It's always good to be here.
Good to have you. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Michael, and Karen.
Let's cut straight to the chase on Russia, Crimea, and what's going on here. Michael Hirsch, are we in a new Cold War?
No, I don't think it's a Cold War. I've suggested you might call it a cool war. You could come up with your own description. But clearly, this is not the great ideological battle of the Cold War between the former Soviet Union and the United States, between fundamentally different systems. What it is more of a kind of cultural and civilizational struggle where for the last 20 years since the Cold War ended, you've seen the eastward expansion of NATO and the European Union absorbing some of the countries that were formerly in the Soviet sphere. And what appears to have happened is Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, has just told the world that his red line has been reached, and that is former constituent parts of Russia itself, which includes Crimea, whose long history has been disputed. And as we saw in 2008, Putin also appeared to draw the line at Georgia, where a Russian-assisted incursion there led to the breakaway of two provinces that are now Russian-controlled. And so we seem to be at a standoff over who gets the rights over these particular territories.
Putin on Tuesday in Moscow in that speech saying, look, you pushed us. Here he is speaking through an interpreter.
They knew perfectly well that there are millions of Russians in Crimea and Ukraine. So why did they lose long-sighted approach? They didn't think of the consequences. If you press the spring too hard, it will recoil.
Russian President Vladimir Putin, of course, the they he's talking about there is Europe, the United States, the West, saying they were bringing European influence, the EU, too close to Russia. Russia's underbelly there. Now we've got Crimea annexed by Russia, and just today, Ukraine going ahead anyway and signing that accord with the EU. That was kind of their move away from that was the spring for all this in the first place. Karen Tumulty, we're not accustomed to other people's red lines being the issue. It's the U.S. that talks about red lines, and here it's Putin. Where are we in this? I mean, there's the fear that he may still look for more in Ukraine, eastern Ukraine and beyond, and Europe has come right back now, Karen, and signed that deal with Kiev that puts them back on Putin's doorstep.
But the question is out there, if he does move forward, what do we do about it? And yesterday, President Obama announced some expansion of sanctions, basically sanctioning some associates of President Putin, one Russian bank, and said the possibility of further sanctions is out there if Putin continues to move forward. But there's a real reluctance, as the president said. If you go forward, it would affect not only Russia's economy, but potentially the world economy. And Europe has shown a lot of reluctance also to be really aggressive with these economic sanctions. What we're talking about here is nowhere near the level of sanctions that we already have, say, against Iran. And so, on the one hand, yes, there are lines being drawn. But on the other hand, there's a real question as to, what capability anybody has to stop Putin.
And with that, this really interesting question of what kind of exercise of power is proving most effective here. We've got tape of the U.S. president on Wednesday in San Diego talking with NBC 7 there, saying no military excursion here. We have other options.
We are not going to be getting into a military excursion in Ukraine. What we are going to do is mobilize all of our diplomatic resources to make sure that we've got a strong international coalition that sends a clear message.
Okay, we're going to mobilize all those diplomatic resources. And yes, there have been sanctions on some, a couple of dozen now, more, one bank. But how far will that go? The president is saying he doesn't want to go down this road. If Russia goes further, he might have to as well. But that hesitance that Karen Tumulty is talking about, you can hear it right here yesterday on the South Lawn of the White House.
This is not our preferred outcome. These sanctions would not only have a significant impact on the Russian economy, but could also be disruptive to the global economy. However, Russia must know that further escalation will only isolate it further from the international community.
Jack Beatty, at this week's end, whose exercise of power is looking more effective here?
Well, Tom, commentators have criticized Barack Obama for reversing Teddy Roosevelt's dictum on Russia. The president is talking loudly and carrying a small stick. Sanction threats haven't deterred Putin. And some think the president is dissipating American prestige. Now, suppose Obama did it TR's way. Suppose he called Putin and said, Vladimir, you need my help and I need yours. I'll do nothing to hurt your economy if you stop at Crimea. I'll press Kiev to ditch the right-wingers and the new government. I'll pump billions into Ukraine, most of which will flow to your banks and Gazprom, and I'll stall on the EU taking in Ukraine. Help me with Iran and Syria, stopping Tehran from getting nukes. That's my Crimea, my big stick moment. You don't want an American war in your backyard. Don't use my Crimea as leverage for your Crimea. Don't let Iran divide us in the current negotiations. On Syria, prod Assad to at least agree to humanitarian ceasefires. What do you say, Vladimir? It's time for a coup of grand strategy through secret diplomacy. What would he say?
Jack, we'll put you right in the Oval Office. Michael Hirsch, the president has spent a lot of time talking with Vladimir Putin on the telephone, but what's he talking about? Is he getting any kind of great deal like that? It looks like he's just getting straight-armed.
Yeah, there has been no suggestion of a grand bargain of the kind that Jack just outlined, nor is there likely to be. Starting off, Putin and Obama do not get along. It's clear from the body language. You see that, in their meetings. And Putin has his own strategy here. I mean, the real danger right now, and getting back to your question about sanctions, I think the single most effective thing was what the EU announced yesterday, which was the resumption of this deal with Ukraine that's set this whole thing in motion, set the protests in motion, because that does go right directly to Putin's greatest fear, that he will lose the rest of Ukraine. By taking Crimea with its 60% ethnic Russian population, essentially what he's done is remove the ethnic Russian vote from the rest of Ukraine, turning it into a distinct minority. So if there is a vote now in the rest of Ukraine about, say, joining the EU, it's much likelier to carry in favor of joining the EU. And that, of course, is exactly what Putin wanted to avoid all along. And so what this raises is, despite assurances we heard yesterday to Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel from his counterpart that Russian troops along the southern and eastern borders of Ukraine were there only for exercises, the very real danger here is that Putin realizes that he has to do something to assume control of greater parts of at least eastern Ukraine. And so that's really the crisis point right now. There's no question that Putin is worried despite his, you know, bluster in his speech the other day.
You call it the most effective move. I mean, I'm sure it will get his attention, but whether it's most effective in keeping him out of eastern Ukraine seems to me an open question. Karen, is Washington lining up behind President Obama and his kind of, you know, new wave, new age style of dealing with a crisis like this? He clearly doesn't want to go military. Maybe there's a very good reason for that, maybe. But is it working? Is he persuading Washington that this is the way to exercise power in the world now?
Well, there has been a lot of criticism, particularly from the Republicans, that, you know, their argument is that they believe the president looks weak in all this. But tellingly, they don't seem to have much by way of, you know, concrete advice as to what he could do differently from what exactly he is doing right now. The American public is not in the mood for any sort of deep military engagement. There are a few people on both sides of the aisle, John McCain, Dick Durbin, who would like to see the United States sending more military aid to Ukraine. But, you know, there is – while there is, you know, a lot of criticism of the president, there is no consensus as to, you know, what else you could do that would be any different. And there was a sort of comical moment yesterday when Putin announced sanctions on a number of Americans, including and of course, that all that did was make everybody want to be on that list.
John McCain and Harry Reid and right on through. What a moment here where it appears to be Putin's strategy that's driving events, though the EU answering back now and the American president saying, steady, we've got sanctions. We'll see how far this goes. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, Flight 370 search, Russia's Crimean annexation and sanctions, military sexual assault back in the headlines. Karen Tumulty is with us, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Michael Hirsch is here, chief correspondent for National Journal. On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Karen, Michael, Jack, callers on Crimea, Ukraine, Power, George in Sheridan, Iowa. George, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I was wondering if you folks had seen the interview with Henry Kissinger on the Charlie Rose show last week. He was very critical of our policy, and he pointed out that the change in government in Ukraine was not constitutional, and it was a result of demonstrations that were not nonviolent. And he was very critical of Victoria Nuland, who's Under Secretary of State, and also our U.S. ambassador to Ukraine for cavorting with the demonstrators in Kiev.
So he was sounding sympathetic to Vladimir Putin then, you're saying, George, that we sort of took it.
Yes, he said our policy was very provocative, and that it's also been pointed out that there are very much fascist elements, outright fascist elements in the new Ukraine government. So that, you know, it creates fear in a lot of minds of people that have a sense of history in that part of the world.
Yeah, it was. There were a whole lot of people of all kinds in the Maidan, but of course, overwhelmingly, it appeared, people who wanted to go with the European Union, but there were lots there. Have to be careful with the fascist tag. Russian, forces, I don't know what to call them, soldiers, people without insignia, throwing that word around now as people get beat up or even killed. I mean, Michael Hirsch, there's Henry Kissinger saying, be careful how far you take this. George Kennan, I think, said something similar back in when he was still pontificating about taking NATO to Russia's doorstep. Who's the big mind driving Obama administration foreign policy now, Michael?
Well, I was told when I asked that question about who is Obama's Kissinger, I was told it was Obama himself. I think that the president himself has been driving foreign policy, although clearly John Kerry and then formerly Hillary Clinton were his chief messengers. And, you know, this is a strain of thinking, going back to Kissinger, that has argued for some time, as we suggested earlier, that the West and the United States have been unnecessarily provocative in expanding eastward to the degree that that we have. And Kissinger came out with an op-ed piece in the last couple of weeks suggesting that one of the elements, one of the solutions to this problem when they – ultimately, it's going to be resolved some one way or another, is that the West and the United States agree not to include Ukraine in NATO, which, of course, you know, would be tremendously provocative and was one of the things that Putin referred to in his speech. And there's going to have to be some sort of a common sense solution that, as Obama himself said last week, allows Ukraine to be both a friend to the West and a friend to Russia.
I don't know where this is going. Jack, these are big wheels turning, and there is no guarantee that we're anywhere near finished here. All kinds of new red lines have been drawn around eastern Ukraine, and it doesn't appear to me at all certain that Putin won't push further there.
Not at all, and it's far from certain whether the things we do to deter him from will, on the contrary, provoke him. For example, EU membership for Ukraine, or even negotiations in that direction. For example, if John McCain, and I've even seen Democrats, Chris Murphy and others, saying, yes, maybe we should look at sending trainers to the Ukrainian army, or, you know, arm. That's the last place we want to go. I think George really hit on it. You know, strategy is putting what matters first. What matters to us right now, overwhelmingly, is avoiding war with Iran. We're on a course to take us there unless these talks work. And Obama in Syria has shown himself shrewdly not willing to get into a proxy war with Iran to preserve that possibility of negotiations. Now he's involved with this whole business with Crimea and Ukraine, not a vital U.S. interest. Ukraine's economy about the size of Philadelphia's, and we're making huge, you know, water over the whole thing. I mean, all kinds of things are in the air. And I think, you know, his strategic sense is he's losing it here, because what really matters for us, for this country, is avoiding war with Iran.
Jack, that's easy for you to say, but what about Latvia? What about all the other Eastern – Poland has really been concerned about this Putin move. Who's to say they're not next if Putin wants to reconstitute something that looks USSR-ish?
Well, but they're members of NATO. They're under the NATO security umbrella. Any attack on those places is an attack on the United States.
Karen, I hear you there.
And interestingly, places like Poland and the Baltics, who are, you know, the most fearful of Russia, have not been really anxious to join in really strong sanctions because the economic implications for them are pretty steep. And I think that, you know, Jack's points are all well taken. And then you look at the other side of this, you know, this is an issue that goes very deeply to the Russian sense of self-identity. Putin is playing a very long game here. What he is doing is very popular domestically at home. And, you know, the Crimean election, the referendum, as much as, you know, we have said it was a rigged election, the outcome does appear to be in line with the sentiment there because it is so heavily ethnic Russian.
Oh, boy. I don't know where this ends. One more call on this one. We've got more to look at. Jacqueline in Melrose, Massachusetts. Jacqueline, you're on the air.
I just think we're in a very weak position to be critical of Russia when we have left Iraq after how many, 8 or 9 years, in a terrible state of destruction and mourning. We killed 175,000 people there, 7,000 children under 11, killed for nothing, for WMDs that never existed. And Obama's letting the war in Afghanistan, which was never approved by Congress, our only war never asked of Congress. It's been going for 13 years, our longest war. We've been killing about 2,000 there every year ourselves. And we've lost several thousand, and men, so many men have committed suicide over there. So who are we to be critical?
Yeah, I take your point. The U.S. has been, yes, we've stomped around a lot. Of course, the country was hit on 9/11, but Michael, I don't know if there's equivalencies in this. I mean, people online saying, hey, you know, hold off. You know, we took all of Texas away from Mexico. Yeah. We're complaining about Crimea.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot of ground to cover there, as it were. It is sort of seen by the Russians as their Texas, and so we have to bear that in mind. As far as what the caller just said, well, no, there was the authorization for the use of military force, which was approved by Congress in the days after 9/11. So the war in Afghanistan was effectively authorized. But to bring it all together, yeah, I think there's a sense that Vladimir Putin realizes that the United States is war-weary, as Obama keeps saying. It's become one of the president's favorite foreign policy phrases, has perceived that the U.S. does need him in these critical talks over Iran and Syria, and was probably gambling, particularly after the reset, the so-called reset, when sanctions were lifted after the 2008 Georgia incursion, that there would not be a severe reaction here. We have to wait and see how that goes. And I don't think that, you know, there have been all these analogies of Putin to Hitler, but Putin, unlike Hitler, doesn't have designs on all of Europe, probably not even Eastern Europe, certainly not the NATO members. I think this is clearly about Crimea, Ukraine, Georgia, the countries that were immediately on that are immediately on Russia's periphery, that have been had a historical identity as very Russian. He keeps referring to, you know, ethnic Russian minorities in some of these countries, and so countries like Estonia and Lithuania do have to think twice. But I don't think that this is something that, you know, blossoms into a another major war.
Nowhere near over, though, this story. And you have to wonder about the knock-on effects. What's China thinking as it looks at those disputed islands with Japan in the East China Sea there? Who cares what the U.S. thinks about what they do? Other big story this week, this missing airline. It'll be 2 weeks tomorrow, and it's all over the media, just dominating so much of the airtime. Here's Bob Hager, longtime aviation correspondent with NBC News, telling the Today Show earlier today, resolving this mystery still remains extremely difficult, despite the news that Australian officials had spotted some stuff off the coast of Perth.
I can't remember a place where it's so remote, so difficult to get at. And I really think it's important to damp down public expectations here. I mean, even the news about these pieces and whether they came from this aircraft, that's going to take, you know, some days or even more. And that doesn't lead you very far, even if you find the pieces were from the plane.
Karen Tumulty, 2 weeks tomorrow, and really nothing settled, nothing solved on this. When does this, you know, when do we say, sorry, it's gone? Or does it, how long can it stay up in the headlines like this?
Well, right now, it is not only assumed to be a tragedy, but something I think that is a source of great fascination to people around the world. Just this idea that, you know, when we assume absolutely everything is, you know, under surveillance by someone, that a plane like this could just disappear. And of course, motives. There's, you know, the potential that we might ever even know what happened to the plane. The latest speculation, which may not be, you know, any better than any of the earlier speculation, with these pieces that have been found in the far southern reaches of the Indian Ocean, which may or may not be related to this plane, would suggest that, you know, this is not an area where somebody would have, you know, hijacked a plane to take it to land it or to even probably, you know, commit suicide. That now there's another theory that maybe it was some sort of hijacking gone awry or mechanical malfunction, that the plane's passengers and crew were just all, you know, we're all
somehow
disabled.
Somehow an autopilot.
Yeah.
Though the Malaysians saying criminal, they've asked the FBI to come out and look at it, you know, deliberately turning off or reprogramming the computer to take it somewhere else. All that remains in the air.
It's just, you know, fascinating. It's the kind of thing, you know, airplanes disappearing. I mean, we still wonder what happened to Amelia Earhart and D.B. Cooper.
It's got everybody thinking about some kind of Himalayan Shangri-La and a big airplane there and everybody, I don't know, doing what? Ronaldo in Chicago. Ronaldo, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
What I don't understand is there are three Americans on that flight, from my knowledge, and the president only made a brief statement about it. He is putting the military in harm's way, and I think knowing how the Malaysians have reacted to this and seeing that it's been below par, we should be stepping up, and the president should be getting involved with this. I mean, with all due respect, the press has covered this more than they did Benghazi.
Ronaldo, I appreciate your call. I mean, he's got a lot to do. There's a lot of people looking for this plane, U.S. planes included, submarine searches and the rest. And I think the FBI has responded and agreed to help the Malaysian government. I don't know, Michael Hirsch, does it have to be the United States' responsibility here, everywhere, everything?
No, you know, clearly not. This was a Malaysia Airlines flight going from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. U.S. ships and, you know, Digital Globe, a U.S.-based satellite company, have assisted in the search. The U.S. Navy, you know, has been involved. This is, as has been said, an incredibly remote area of the world that just reminds us how huge the Earth is, and the fact that we can't really surveil all of it at once. And it's been a tragedy as well as a revelation in that respect. I mean, as Karen was suggesting with the allusions to Amelia Earhart, we may never know what really happened. There's some evidence that this debris that was spotted may have already sunk. They're having a hard time locating it. The South Indian Ocean in that area, the depths are incredible. You know, up to 15,000 feet or so, and so it's possible that this could go on for years.
Well, we know what goes up must come down. Even news stories at some point, but I wonder when and what we'll ever learn out of this one. I want to turn to a big military sexual assault case with a, to many, surprising conclusion this week. The highest ranking U.S. military officer ever court-martialed in a sexual assault case, Army Brigadier General Jeffrey Sinclair, off with a fairly minor reprimand this week after an expectation that he might be sent away to jail for a long, long time. He won't be. Here he is talking with reporters outside the military courtroom in Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
It's been a very difficult time for me and my family. It really has. The system worked. I've always been proud of my Army. All I want to do now is go up north and hug my kids and see my wife.
And here's the attorney for the Army captain, woman, who first accused him, Jamie Barnett, talking with CBS's Wyatt Andrews after the ruling.
He admitted guilt, 14 crimes, but he's not really being punished for it. So there's no really justice for this young captain. I'm afraid it will have a chilling effect. And after talking to my client today, I mean, now she is just devastated by this and wonders if it was worth it.
Karen Tumulty, there has been so much talk on Capitol Hill about fixing the military's system for handling sexual assault charges. And then to see this very high-profile officer walk, how do you interpret what's happened here legally and what ramifications for policy down the road, Karen?
Well, the punishment basically that he just has to find, you know, be reprimanded and pay a fine was surprisingly light, the punishment that the judge had meted out. He had actually agreed in his plea bargain to go to jail for as much as 18 months. And, you know, there was a real question of whether he would lose his pension. That didn't even happen. So, you know, it does hit at the – and there, the very day this happens, there's a, you know, a Naval Academy case where a former football player was found not guilty of sexual assault of one of his fellow midshipmen. This is coming as Congress is debating this. A few weeks ago, the Senate decided to vote – they voted against something that would have taken the chain of command out of these prosecutions. So yes, you're having one side saying this proves the system works, the other side saying it doesn't. But what you're already seeing, for instance, in the, cases of the academies, that the people are worrying there is a chilling effect, that the number of sexual assaults being reported is going down even as the number of people seeking treatment without reporting a sexual assault is going up.
Jack Beattie, are we making progress on this problem here? What happened in this big case?
Well, it doesn't sound as if we are at all. However, there is a wrinkle on this case that makes it not exactly a good example, and that is that the judge found that the prosecution had been politically tainted, namely that the Pentagon was so eager to show, hey, our procedures work, we don't need new reforms, we're going to nail this guy. They were so eager to do that that they kept pressing for the charge, the prosecution did, of sexual assault. This was after the victim had been found in a provable lie. So, in other words, you to go ahead with a case like that made no sense, and they wouldn't go, they put off going for any shorter sentence, and he felt, any shorter charge, and less serious charge, and the judge felt that this was political influence on the prosecution.
A little fine, and off he goes, Army Brigadier General Jeffrey Sinclair, after all that. Fascinating what works and doesn't work in that realm, but still big problems, big numbers in terms of military sexual assault. Jack Beattie, please stand by. Karen Tumulty with The Washington Post. Michael Hirsch at National Journal. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is
On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, in Seattle, a deadly news helicopter crash by the Space Needle. Como meteorologist Seth Wayne was early on the fiery scene.
It's those sounds of the engines of the cars and the gas that's just ripping apart everything. And just literally, you see explosion after explosion, and there was a trail of jet fuel.
Scientists capture the first ever signal from the beginning of the universe. One Stanford professor, Andre Linde, got the surprise news of confirmation of his 30-year-old angle on the Big Bang theory at his front door.
So I have a surprise for you.
Wow.
It's 5 sigma at 0.2.
Discovery.
Yes.
What? Just a second. Can you repeat it?
5 sigma, as clear as day, are a 0.2.
That is scientific dismay. And founder of the Westboro Baptist Church, Fred Phelps, is dead at 84. He was known for his extreme anti-gay protests at soldiers' funerals. He preached hate.
God Almighty mentions his hatred, his wrath, his indignation at the sins of mankind more than he talks about his love. So if you're a Bible preacher, you're preaching hate.
Yeah. We're looking at a week in the news. The 370 search, Russia's Crimean annexation, sanctions, military sexual assault. Back in the headlines, Karen Tumulty is with us from The Washington Post. Michael Hirsch from National Journal. Jack Beatty's here. The president out again this week trying to get people's attention, saying sign up now on Obamacare. Here he was with comedian Ellen DeGeneres on Thursday, chatting with her about House of Cards, life in the White House, when his family is away, and, of course, Obamacare.
The website is not working. Healthcare.gov actually works the way it's supposed to, and I hope that people take advantage, because if you don't sign up before March 31st, then you won't be able to sign up again until November. And I want to make sure that everybody has this opportunity now.
It's doing very, very well. I think it's surprised. It had a rough start, but you've got 5 million people that have signed up so far, which is an enormous amount of people that have signed up.
Ellen DeGeneres sounding kind of on the team there. Karen Tumulty, how is it doing? It's just a week before this next March 31st big deadline. Are they going to make the numbers they want, they need?
Well, they had originally hoped that 7 million would be signed up by the end of this month, and now they're scaling back those expectations to 6 million. And one of the big concerns is getting up the numbers of healthy people who sign up, because those are the people they really need, because their premiums are going to pay for, you know, the coverage that takes care of sicker people and older people. I do wonder at this point, though, if the, you know, White House thinks that their problem here is that they think they can market their way around what it remains to be, you know, a public that is not entirely accepting of this. And for a lot of young people, you know, seeing the president on, you know, Between Two Ferns, an internet show, is not going to, you know, it may increase awareness of this, but it comes down to an economic decision. And for a lot of young people, you know, they'll take their chances. They, you know, they'll pay the fines, which aren't really that high, rather than paying for, you know, for a lot of them, what is pretty expensive coverage.
Michael Hirsch, there's the political question, how this plays out in the fall. But what about just the practical question now? Is it coming together with the numbers sufficient to make all this work as the president hopes?
I just think it's too soon to say. We can say that it seems they've fixed the biggest problems with the website, which, of course, was just absolutely a disastrous rollout. It could not have been done worse. The Republicans pounced. You've had a number of Republican governors, particularly in states that need Medicare, rejecting the Medicare expansion. That's part of the plan. So it's impossible to sort of unscramble the omelet here in terms of the politics of it and the policy of it. We may have to wait a long time to see just how effective this is. As Karen said, it's absolutely critical that they get healthy people to reduce costs overall. Five, six million sounds substantial, but contrary to what Ellen DeGeneres said, it's still a very small slice of the population that they're looking for. And so I think, you know, the bottom line is, for a long time to come, we're going to see this light up as a political issue.
Coming together, Jack, what do you think? What do you see?
Well, the numbers, in the gross, that doesn't look seem so bad given the tough start they had. On the other hand, the composition the last time I looked didn't look so promising. They weren't getting as many young people as they wanted. But insurance companies say, well, we don't need 40%. We can do with less than that. Well, who knows? But I quite agree. This is for the Republican Party. This is the gift that keeps on keeping. We just had that special election in Florida that went to the Republican. Many people think on this issue, the Democratic candidate said, I want to mend it, not end it. And the Republican said, end it. And that won. We don't know that was the issue. It certainly was prominent up here in New Hampshire. Scott Brown is running against Gene Shaheen. He's just come over the border from Massachusetts. And he's saying, hey, she backed Obamacare. That's not good for New Hampshire. She vote her out. Well, we'll see how that works. But all over the country, Republicans are using it.
Harry in Madison, Wisconsin. Harry, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you see?
Well, I think the big backlash is going to come if you look at a lot of Americans that have health insurance right now. Most of them did a policy extension till the end of 2014. I know personally our health insurance premium right now, I'm married and I have three children. Our health insurance premiums are $504 right now. The exact same policy is going to be $1,253 after the first of the year. So I think you're going to see the real political implications once people that have health insurance are forced to switch.
So not when they're out, but when they're in. Harry, I appreciate your call. Let's get one more right here. Bob in Bloomington, Indiana. Bob, you're on the air.
Yeah, hey, how you doing?
All right, what's your story?
I'm 42, self-employed, and I just signed up for Obamacare, and it's reduced my premium by about $100 a month. My insurance is much better. I'm happy.
And you've really run the numbers. You understand what's going on there. And your bottom line looks like a net gain to you, Bob.
Oh yeah. I mean, I had a much higher deductible before, and now that's lowered. I've got a lot more things that add quality to the plan, and I'm saving about $100 a month.
It sounds like a win for you. How this plays out, how the public comes to understand it, going to be very interesting. The White House pulling out all the stops. They got LeBron James out with an ad for it this week and all the rest. I appreciate your call,
Tom,
as well. Karen, please, yeah.
Yeah, it's probably worth pointing out with both Harry and Bob's cases, it does sound like the vast majority of people in this country already get their coverage through their employer. What we're talking about, Bob is self-employed. Harry, it sounds like, buys his policies on the individual market. So this is it's a relatively small slice of the population, but these are the people, kind of people who have to go out and buy their own insurance who are being affected, one way or the other.
Of course, many without insurance and all those young people they're hoping for coming off their parents' plan if they've been on it at 26. I guess that's their sweet spot if they can sign them up. Healthcare is big, auto industry also big, and news on a couple of fronts this week. Another GM recall after last week's big hullabaloo, big fine on Toyota. We saw GM CEO Mary Barra, who had not come out quickly after that recall. She did appear. This was a video for GM employees, but released to the public on Monday with a statement about the handling of a flawed ignition switch. Mary Barra.
Something went wrong with our process in this instance, and terrible things happened. As a member of the GM family and as a mom with a family of my own, this really hits home for me. We have apologized, but that is just one step in the journey to resolve this.
Not a barn burner. We'll see how that one plays out. Toyota with a big fine, $1.2 billion record settlement with the Justice Department. Here was Preet Bharara, U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, talking about that recall that led to the recall of the unintended acceleration, the recall of more than 10 million vehicles.
Today, one of the largest car makers in the world stands charged with a criminal offense. Toyota Motor Corporation is in that position because it cared more about savings than safety, because it cared more about its own brand and bottom line than the truth.
Michael Hirsch, is this timing accidental that we've got the news of the fine coming out just when GM is really squirming on its own, made in America recalls?
Well, clearly the Justice Department is pushing hard here, and this is, you know, Mary Barra's baptism of a fire, if you will. As the incoming chairperson. And I think what the Toyota issue holds out to her is a lesson in how not to do things. You know, we keep revisiting these issues of sort of corporate morality and how corporations should own up to errors. Barra has said some good things. She's scheduled to testify before Congress on April 1 about this. What remains a big question mark in terms of GM's future is whether it will accept liability for these deaths, about 12 deaths that have been ascribed to this ignition switch problem that goes back more than a decade. Now, the issue here is they legally perhaps do not have to accept liability because of the 2009 bankruptcy filing. And the question will be whether Mary Barra, tries to get out ahead of this this scandal and avoid what happened to Toyota, which, remember, used to be the company that was most valued for its safety. It had a wonderful reputation, which was badly damaged by this $1.2 billion fine.
That will be fascinating. Mighty tempting to leave that liability back there on the other side of the bailout and bankruptcy.
Right.
How nice that would be. I want to talk about Rand Paul a little bit, if we can. He's got an interesting itinerary lately. He'll be talking with the NAACP soon. He was at Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley, liberal territory this week. Of course, he was talking with the Berkeley College Republicans, but interesting choice of target, kind of a big tent choice. He was talking there in part about his class action suit against the Obama administration and the National Security Agency, and what he said was surveillance overreach by the CIA, one of his libertarian themes.
If the CIA is spying on Congress, who exactly can or will stop them? I look into the eyes of senators and I think I see real fear. Maybe it's just my imagination, but I think I perceive fear of an intelligence community that's drunk with power, unrepentant, and uninclined to relinquish power.
Jack Beatty, what do you see in Rand Paul's a date book lately?
Well, you know, he's that rarity, an unconventional politician. He's got a knack for making news. 3 weeks ago, for example, he captured a week-long news cycle by calling Bill Clinton a sexual predator on Meet the Press. Paul chooses issues with a crossover appeal like the NSA spying. He preaches to hostile choirs, students at Berkeley this week, the NAACP, as you said, soon. And talk about rare. At a time when the GOP candidate for governor in Texas campaigns with Ted Nugent, who's called Obama, quote, a subhuman mongrel, end quote, Rand Paul is one Republican who goes out of his way to say he likes the president. Politicians should disagree without being disagreeable, he says. He's planting the idea that he's a healing figure, not another polarizing Paul. You know, he would be, if they nominated him, the Republicans did, on domestic policy, the most conservative GOP nominee since Barry Goldwater. And it's just in 2014, it's hard to imagine him denting that Obama 332 electoral votes in 2012. But it's hard to name any figure in American politics today who's more interesting than this guy.
Lots interesting going on. A report just coming out that Joe Biden will be up in New Hampshire soon. I don't know what his presidential thoughts are at this point. Karen Tumbley, what about Rand Paul? Is there a calculus in which he emerges as the GOP flag bearer?
You know, it is really hard. Well, one thing is that you have to learn as a political reporter that you should never assume that the last cycle will tell you how things are going to work out the next cycle. But it is hard seeing him getting past a lot of the institutional barriers, the evangelicals in Iowa. But he is on to something here in that to the degree young people are being attracted to the Republican Party and conservatism, it is toward this kind of libertarian strain of conservatism. And, Rand Paul really speaks to that, and not just on these issues, but on things also. He's been reaching out on things like, you know, mandatory sentencing laws, which he says really, you know, fall too heavily on African Americans and other minorities. He is very unconventional, and this is something that in particular young people who potentially are the future of the Republican Party are attracted to.
Interesting to watch where he goes and who he chooses to speak to. Unorthodox kind of angle of his own on politics. Not so different from his dad's, but he's making it his own. Economy, interesting this week, Janet Yellen, in the chair now as Federal Reserve Chair, had her first press conference in that position this week, got specific about her plans for the Fed. A Reuters reporter asked Janet Yellen how long it would be after the end of the Fed's asset purchases before the first interest rate hike. Her response, kind of surprisingly specific, went on to startle the markets that day.
It's hard to define, but, probably means something on the order of around 6 months or that type of thing. But, it depends what the statement is saying is it depends what conditions are like.
Fed chair utterances, always fascinating what they say and what they don't. Michael Hirsch, what does it look like the economy she's coming into and the first signals from Yellen on where she'd like to push it?
Well, that statement was probably a rookie error, if you will. It was her first news conference.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's got to learn a little bit more about studied ambiguity that at one point Alan Greenspan was so much the master of. But the big news coming out of this Fed meeting was that she's taking a whole new look, despite preaching continuity with the Bernanke Fed, a whole new look at the conditions under which Fed hikes, rate hikes could begin again. Whereas previously the Fed had said specifically they wanted to see unemployment drop to 6.5%, the new guidance is they're going to look at a whole bunch of different conditions, and I think that's what she was alluding to there. And the markets were rattled because anytime there's any hint of a different direction from the Fed, they get rattled one way or another, or they go up. So what we don't know, though, is really what will be the specific conditions that would prompt Yellen to begin going from zero interest rates upward again. And we know she's very concerned about unemployment. She has been for her entire career as an economist. So it's really impossible to predict.
Karen Templety, you reorganizing your portfolio for high interest rates in this country?
Well, it's amazing, though, that I think everybody who has stock market investments in their retirement accounts is at least feeling a little richer these days.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see what lasts and how Janet Yellen taking the harness there for an economy still not quite off the ground, but we're all watching. Karen Tubley with The Washington Post. It's always great to have you with us on a Friday. Thank you very much for being here today. Thanks, Karen.
My pleasure.
Michael Hirsch, chief correspondent for National Journal. Thanks so much, Michael.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, thanks to you, sir.
Thank you.
We'll talk Obamacare on Monday. Be there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.